I used to think of myself as one of the most well-known lonely women in America. I didn't really have any close friends, but everyone who looked at me thought, wow, she's doing great. What a great job. And how, look how the Lord is using her. I would go out on weekends and be part of seminars or speak or crusades and see so many people responding to the Lord. But I would go back to my hotel room and feel like a lonely, lost soul.
Perhaps you can identify with that sense of deep, deep loneliness that's expressed there. Maybe you've been diagnosed with cancer, or you've lost a loved one, or you're going through a divorce, or you're just desperately trying to keep everything together, but it isn't working. I'm John Fuller, and our speaker there is Mrs. Sheila Walsh. And on today's Focus on the Family, we're coming back to a message from her that received an incredible response. Here's what one woman wrote on our Facebook page. She said, "Anyone who is depressed or lonely really needs to listen to this. It certainly got to my heart, as I pray it does many others." And another listener said, "This was an awesome program. I had gone to get pizza for lunch and had to pull over and listen. And I just cried and cried." Well, I do hope you will listen along with us here for a pretty incredible program. It offers great encouragement along the way. And our host for the program, our Focus President Jim Daly, and psychologist Dr. Julie Slattery. I'm John Fuller, and here now, our conversation with Sheila Walsh, one of our Focus on the Family Best of 2011 broadcasts.
John, you know, our core mission at Focus on the Family is to reach people with the gospel. I mean, that's at the heart of everything we do. We can repair a family, but if we don't introduce them to the author of family, we've missed the mark. And to help them realize they're never alone and that God is the God of the universe and loves them completely and unconditionally, and that He has a plan and a purpose for each life. That's the important core thing that we do. God Himself has promised us in the book of Hebrews, "Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you." That's Hebrews 13:5. And you know, sometimes with the pain of life, we forget that. And today we want you to remember that.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jim, even as you speak of those scriptures and those promises that God loves us and He'll never leave us or forsake us, for some people listening, that sounds almost like mocking because they feel forsaken and they don't feel God's love. Mm. And the reality is sometimes we have to reach that rock bottom before we begin to experience the reality of what's been true all along. Mm-hmm. And the guest we have with us in studio today has an amazing testimony of that. Her music has touched many, many lives, but really the story of her journey with the Lord is powerful, and I think it's really going to resonate with people who are feeling that loneliness today. Mm.
And that was her speaking at the beginning here just a moment ago, talking about being a lonely but well-known woman. We're talking about Sheila Walsh, who is a Bible teacher, a best-selling author, a recording artist. She sold, 4 million books, I think. She's spoken for years with Women of Faith, and she and her husband Barry and their son Christian live in Frisco, Texas. And it's great to have you here, Sheila.
It's nice to be here.
Sheila, you've been a Christian for a while, 11 years old. That struck me. Let's start there. Let's talk about your background, where you're from, and how you came to the Lord early in life.
I was born on the west coast of Scotland, a small fishing town. You can probably tell by my accent, even though I live in Texas, I'm not a native.
It doesn't sound like a Texas accent.
No, and thank you for that, yes.
Hey, we have friends in Texas.
I know, I live in Texas.
Don't mess with Texas.
They know where I live.
That's right.
Yeah, don't mess with Texas. But no, I was born in a small fishing town, and I was born to very committed Christian parents, which would not be unusual in the States, but very unusual in the United Kingdom, where less than 2% of our population go to church. Mm. So to have a mom and dad who didn't just go to church, but actually passionately loved Jesus was very different. And I often think, when I think about my early life, I think of the movie The Wizard of Oz. I think of when Dorothy is at the very beginning of the film in this very bleak landscape, thinking that somewhere over a rainbow, there's a place where any dream that you dare to dream really could come true. And she may have been dreaming for a rainbow. What she didn't know was it was a tornado that was heading in her direction. And that was true of my life. When I was 5 years old, went to bed one night, life was wonderful, everything was great. by the next morning, nothing would ever be the same again. My father had had massive cerebral hemorrhage during the night and was in intensive care, not expected to live. But he did live, he did survive, but he was different. He was paralyzed down one side, couldn't speak, never spoke a word again. But when he came home, I determined, because I was the one that was closest to my dad. My sister's what every mother prays for. You know, she's the one who wants to wear a dress and have ribbons in her hair. I wanted to climb a tree and see if I could touch the moon. And so I was very close to my father. And when my dad began to take brain storms, when the blood clot moved and affected an area in his brain that touched on his personality, he became a very unpredictable, violent stranger. And the only person he took that initial violence out on until the very last day was me. You know, he would spit in my face or pull my hair. And as a child, as you well know, with, I mean, what you do here, children are the best recorders of information, but the poorest interpreters. And all I could think of was, I need to do better. Whatever it is that my dad is seeing in me, I need to do better. But the last day I ever saw my dad alive was sitting by the fire, playing with my dog, and suddenly hearing her growl, which I'd never heard before. And as I turned, I saw that my dad was about to bring his cane down on my skull. And just an instinct, I imagine, I reached up and grabbed it, and my father fell hard, just screaming like an animal. And my mom and took my sister, my brother, and I locked us in her bedroom as she dialed 911. Only a few minutes for them to get help, but I thought my dad was going to kill my mom that day. But what remained with me, he was committed to a psychiatric institution. He was 34 years old.
Wow.
And he died a few months later. But the last look I saw in the eyes of this man I adored was one of complete hatred. And so I was left with this deep sense of not guilt, because I couldn't think what I'd done wrong, but shame, which was, I am wrong.
How did you process that as a little girl? I mean, how did God maintain his grip on your heart?
Because my mom took me to hear Scotland's only gospel group. They were terrible. But I do remember the guy at the end saying, God has no grandchildren. He only has sons and daughters. You have to choose for yourself. And so that night when I came home, I asked my mom if she would pray with me. And she said something to me which would have been a wonderful thing to the ears of most people, but I heard something completely different. She said, not only does Jesus live in your heart, you now have a heavenly Father who's watching over you. And in my heart, I thought that night, I have a second chance to get it right. So whatever my dad saw in me that was so horrible, God will never see. And I spent the next 30 years of my life trying to make sure that God never turned on me.
And Sheila, for those of us who didn't grow up having strong relationships with our earthly fathers, it can be so hard to understand there's a heavenly Father who loves us.
I think I just came into my relationship with God with so much baggage, you know, with such a sense of every day I've got to be good enough. I have to be the perfect Christian woman. And I think when you're wounded in your childhood and you don't know what to do with the pain, you look for a place to hide. You know, it's either drugs or alcohol or sex. I found the perfect place, which is Christian ministry.
Sheila, losing ourselves in the church and doing things for God, like you just described, is really a natural tendency for all of us to fall into. But I want for you to talk just a minute about a word you used earlier, shame. That's a word we throw around often. When we feel shame, that deeply hidden shame, it controls you. It compels you. It makes you want to try to be perfect. Talk about what shame is and how we recognize it.
Shame to me is one of the most debilitating emotions that we can ever deal with. It's as if someone has soaked a heavy wool blanket in a cold Scottish ocean and draped it over your shoulders. And so I've basically made myself valuable to other people in what I would do. So I volunteered for everything. I did everything. But I never opened up, because my thing was, if you got to know if you see what my dad saw, you know, you're going to vote me off the island. So I'm never going to let you see that. It's such a, the hard thing is you can't resolve it. If I had had a fight with my father and that caused the end of our relationship, if I had done something and he had done something, there would have been something to process and something to ask forgiveness for. But if you just feel that what you are is wrong, if you feel that at your very core, there's no goodness there. I mean, I used to think when I was growing up, people would say to me when I was a teenager, Sheila, you're just like your dad. And I think they meant you're funny like your dad or you sing like your dad. What I heard was there's a crack in your soul like your father. And one of these days, no matter how fast you run, it's going to catch up with you. Mm. So I just determined to, even as my life went on, I mean, I was just the most involved person. If you just looked at the surface, you would have thought, well, you know, here's one together kid. Mm. And I thought that that would make God always love me.
Sheila, you're speaking to something that is deep within many people in the Christian faith, this idea that if we work hard enough, we'll be acceptable. In essence, that's some of what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. I believe that with every fiber of my being.
Speak to us right now, the revelation of that, how that got corrected in your life. I mean, it was a tremendous moment when you realized, wait a minute, it's a shaky foundation here.
Well, it was probably one of the most devastating, grace-filled moments of my life. And it happened many years later. Because I went to seminary to train to be a missionary in India because I couldn't think of anything I would hate more. And I thought that that would be an indication to God of how much I loved him. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to travel overseas to where they've got, you know, snakes the size of Texas. You know, I'm going to hate it, but I just want you to know I'm doing it for you, God, because I love you. And then eventually I became a Christian recording artist. Mm-hmm. Eventually I become co-host of the 700 Club. But one day in 1992, I went from, in the morning, sitting beside Dr. Pat Robertson as his co-host. By that evening, I was in the locked ward of a psychiatric hospital, and I was 34 years old. I was exactly the same age as my father. Mm.
At that moment, were you cognizant of the things that you heard in your mind years before, that your cracked heart, like your father?
At that moment, I felt it was over. Mm. I remember driving, Pat wanted one of his security guys to drive me to the hospital in Washington. And I said, absolutely not, because this was the end for me. If you've spent your whole life trying to prove to people that you're okay, and you end up walking through doors that will lock behind you, I couldn't stand the shame of anyone else seeing me walk through those doors.
Mm. You know, Sheila, as you talk about that moment of walking through those doors, there's a lot of pain. It's devastating. But before we talk about that pain, can you talk a little bit about what it was like for years and years and years and years to try to pretend like everything was okay?
Mm. Very lonely.
And having all that success, too. I mean, mm-hmm. in the midst of all that success.
Mm-hmm. The way I would describe it, if I could give you a picture, and in fact, it actually happened while I was in the hospital. They gave me a piece of clay one day and said, model something that represents your life. And I said, that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard. You know, and they said, you think too much, just do it. And when I looked at what I'd actually modeled, it broke my heart. Because it was, I had a circle, a high-walled circle. And inside was a little figure with very long arms who could reach out and hug you if you're broken or wipe a tear from your face. But nobody got to come over the wall because I couldn't let them see me. So it was just desperately lonely. And I cannot tell you the number of times where I would say, God, if there's just something you could show me. I mean, I remember twice fasting and praying for 21 days and saying, God, if you'll just show, if there's something in me, you know, if it was some sin that I could confess, you know, why did I always feel this despair and that no matter what I did, it would never be enough?
Yeah. You know, Jim, I'm just so struck to hear the testimony of a woman who's so sold out to the Lord and who was so seeking him, but still felt like God was distant. And I think we probably have people listening right now who are in that boat saying, God, just show me. I'm praying, I'm fasting, I'm serving. Where are you? How do you get to the point where you're striving so hard to feel God's love but not able to feel it to when he overwhelms you with it?
Well, it's really interesting. I'm fascinated by God's merciful ways, which never initially appear merciful to me. They appear severe. Hmm. God literally took me to the place of my nightmares. I never went back to that hospital where my father died. It was this old gray, they called it an asylum back then in Scotland, at this horrible building. And my father actually escaped one night and was found the next morning caught in the salmon nets in the river. And I would never go near that place. It was just, so for me, if you'd asked me as a young woman, what's your greatest fear? It would not have been to be raped or to be anything. It would have been to end up in that place. Mm-hmm. So God in his mercy took me to the place of my greatest nightmares. It was almost like he took me to prison to set me free, to show me. And it was when everything was gone. When I mean, the first night they go through everything. They take your belts, your hose, your makeup, your hair dryer. And I thought, this morning I was trusted with a national television audience. Tonight I'm not trusted with a hair dryer.
Did you check yourself in?
I did. I did check myself in because I have a very dear friend, Dr. Henry Cloud. Mm-hmm. And I fell apart on TV one morning when a guest that I was interviewing, instead of answering my first question, turned to me and said, Sheila, you sit here every day and you ask us questions. How are you doing? And she meant it as a kind, friendly, warm, and I did not have time to pull my defenses up. And I did what I vowed I would never do. And I started to cry and I couldn't stop.
And that was because?
It was because I felt as if I was living in the darkest, deepest place. And I couldn't, if I'd known the question was coming, I would have had a great answer. I would have said, you know what? I have good days and bad days, but I'm so grateful that God loves me and he's committed to finishing the work he's begun in me. And I would have believed that, but I wouldn't have opened the door to the cellar. But because I didn't have any warning, I think it was God's mercy. I think God just said, Sheila, this is enough. I came to give you life, not survival. I came to give you life.
And then you cried because you really couldn't answer the
question. Well, I hadn't cried for years. My thing was, if I start to cry, I'll never stop. So I just won't start. And when she asked, and it was the look in her eyes. It was such a kind, compassionate look. And I couldn't answer her because I thought, I can't tell you a lie, but I can't tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. But in other situations, you obviously, people would ask you how you're doing and your guard would be up.
Yeah.
And therefore you wouldn't answer it. Sheila, you said something a moment ago I really want to get back to, and that is you said he took me, meaning God, he took me to prison to set me free. In your book, you made a statement that catches our attention. You said, when heaven invades your hell, it wins your heart's allegiance. Describe that for us.
After I'd been in the hospital for maybe 3 weeks, I was given a pass, you know, where I could go with a nurse to a movie or a mall. And I said to this young nurse, look, what I'd like to do is go to church. I don't care which denomination, as long as it's a Bible-believing church. And so she took me to this little Episcopalian church in Washington, D.C., and I sat in the back pew with the sun coming through the stained glass windows, and I've never felt so lost. Because if you spend your whole life trying to get it all right and you end up in a place that says it's all wrong, what do you do with that? And I remember the pastor got up and said, some of you in here feel as if you're dead inside, almost as if God is beginning to heap the earth on top of your casket. And he said, but I want you to know, Jesus is here. And you don't even have to get yourself out of the hole. You just have to reach out and grab hold of his hand. And I have never in my life walked an aisle to the front of a church or a meeting. I ran to the front of that church and I lay face down in front of the altar. Mm-hmm. And the words to a hymn that my grandmother used to sing to me when I was a little girl, the hymn was Rock of Ages, but the words that came back were, nothing in my hands I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. And I finally got it, that it was not about me getting it right. I am not the good news. Mm-hmm. Never have been, never will be. And it was the most startlingly grace-filled moment I've ever experienced in my life, where at your worst, you look into the face of God and he's smiling.
How many people hear this right now, Sheila, that have perhaps worked their entire lives to please God, to please those around them, but to come to that incredible moment where you understand that your worst day, God still loves you and he cares for you. When you did this, did you feel judgment coming from the church? Did you feel a bit off in those relationships with your Christian friends?
Absolutely. In fact, one relationship has still not been healed. That was very painful. Someone who'd been a dear friend for years. And they were disappointed on two levels. One, that I was in a psychiatric hospital. But two, when they heard that I was on medication. That was the deal breaker for them. And I've tried since then to restore that relationship, and so far that has not been possible.
What was the deal with the medication, that you weren't relying on God?
Their whole premise was, if you had enough faith, you wouldn't need this. Hmm. And I mean, I had no answer for that then. Now I would simply say, well, you know, if you get to 40 and you have to wear reading glasses, does that mean that your faith in God has diminished over the years? Or, you know, we don't say that to people who take insulin. But I remember saying to the psychiatrist the very first morning, I don't want any of your happy pills. And he said, he was very kind. I'm sure he was used to people like me. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I don't want some pill that's going to make me feel good about myself, so I walk around drooling on myself, talking to some imaginary dog and being happy about it. And he began to explain brain chemistry. I'm just one of those people who do not produce enough serotonin to be able to function well. And the first 2 weeks were very difficult. But what was more difficult was when I left the hospital and I had to go to a regular drugstore and fill that first prescription. Because I thought, I mean, having been on national television for 5 years, a lot of people recognized me. And I thought, what will I say? If they say, oh, did you get the flu too? Or what will I say? And I was very ashamed. And by the way, I still take medication today, all these years later. But I have learned to take that little pill every morning with a prayer of thanksgiving that God has provided for those of us who need that kind of help in this world. Mm-hmm.
Sheila, I would think, given your background and given what you saw in your father when he had his stroke, the massive hemorrhage, and how it changed his brain chemistry, that was not the man you knew. It was a different person. And that was an extreme example. But that, in some ways, is what you're talking about even now, is that that brain chemistry can change us, make us different than who God intends us to be.
That is very true. And one of the reasons that I am still on medication is because of an incident that happened with my son when he was probably 6 years old. I see my psychiatrist twice a year, and it's still such an inexact science in many ways. I mean, it's improving, but it's still such an inexact science. And I said to him, I would really like to try and taper myself off this medication and see how I do. And so we came up with a game plan and did that. And for the first 2 or 3 weeks, I felt great. I felt very alive, very awake. And then I began to feel that familiar cycling where I'd feel myself disappearing a little or being pulled, and even the way that my thinking would be affected. Something that was difficult became impossible. Something that was hard became overwhelming. But one night at dinner, our son Christian is not the kind of boy, I've never had to raise my voice to him. He's the kind of kid that, you know, I just have to say, Christian? And he gets it. But one night at dinner, he knocked something over, and all I said was his name. But there was something in the tone of my voice that he had never heard before. And I saw a look in his eyes, and I thought, no, I am not going to let my pride in wanting to be pill-free give my son a crazy mother. So I excused myself from the table, and I went to my bedroom, and I called my doctor, and I said, can I come in tomorrow morning? And this made me cry. Underneath the door came this little note from my son, which I carry with me everywhere I go. And he said, dear mom, I hope you feel better soon, because I think you're a great mom. Mm. And I thought, you know what? This is crazy. I want to be a good wife, a good mom, a good friend. And if I have to take pills until the day I see Jesus face to face, then count me in.
Mm. Yeah. That story is so touching. I noticed that you used the word pride. And I don't think a lot of people would use that word in describing that. They'd say, I want to get healthy. I don't want to be dependent. Why was that a choice against your pride?
Because I think we think any kind of medication to do with any kind of mental illness is a flaw in our character. You know, and I think there's still, you know, and there's complications with insurance. There's like a whole gamut of things that you have to talk about. But there's some struggles that have greater curb appeal than others. If I had a brain tumor, and I sent out a Twitter or put it on my Facebook page, you know, I'm struggling with this. I mean, the troops would gather from all across the country. Those who know me or have any relationship with me at all would have prayer meetings, and they would intercede. But if I put it out, I'm struggling with clinical depression, some people would understand and say, oh gosh, we're praying for you. And some people would be like, well, just get your act together. Or, you know, is there some sin in your life? That taking that, being willing to take that pill is accepting the fact that that will be difficult for some people.
Sheila, that is a good reminder, because whenever we raise this topic, people have concerns. Christians who are needing medication will have a concern. That's true of my wife, Jean. And she's come to that conclusion where if she had diabetes or some other obvious physical need, she would easily take that medication. Sheila, there's so much more to your story, and we need to finish that. Will you come back next time?
I'd love to.
Well, you're listening to Focus on the Family, and our guest has been Sheila Walsh, and we certainly do want to come alongside you in whatever struggle you might be facing, and I think this broadcast can offer some perspective and some hope. And certainly Sheila's book would also be of help to you. It's called The Shelter of God's Promises and has some great advice and some scriptural references that you can cling to in the midst of difficult times. It might be that our conversation today has left you with some questions about your spiritual journey. And if so, we have a pretty rich website. There's one thing I would point out, a booklet that we've posted the text to and that we can send to you if you'd like. It's called Coming Home, An Invitation to Join God's Family. And tens of thousands of people have found this to be helpful in developing a better understanding of what it's like to have a relationship with God through His Son, Jesus Christ. And you can find that, other helpful resources, downloads, and CDs of this conversation at focusonthefamily.com/radio, or call us to request information about these resources or to get in touch with somebody in our counseling department. We have trained, caring counselors, and they'd be happy to speak with you. And the number to call during business hours is 800-232-6459. 800, the letter A, and the word family. Well, as we close, let me just share a thought with you that has guided this ministry from its earliest days. The people who need family ministry most can't always afford to support it, but that's never stopped us from providing the help they need. And if you're in a situation where you can send along a gift so we can continue to reach out to hurting individuals and families, we would appreciate that deeply. A gift of $28 today will provide one struggling family with help, or $56 can help two families. Of course, any amount will go a long, long way as we endeavor to help families thrive. Our program today was provided by Focus on the Family. And on behalf of Jim Daly, Dr. Julie Slattery, and the entire team here, thanks for listening in. I'm John Fuller, inviting you back tomorrow, when we'll continue this Best of the Best broadcast with Sheila Walsh, and once again, turn our hearts toward home.